ribbons of blue cellophane adhered. They walked, holding hands, swinging their hands rhythmically. The soldier on the outside had a large brown paper bag filled with cold canned beer. They strolled softly in the pearly light. They had had a hell of a time, and they felt good. They smiled delicately, like weary children remembering a party. They looked at one another and smiled, and they swung their hands. Past the bear flag they went and said "Hiya" to the bouncer who was scratching his stomach. They listened to the snores from the pipes and laughed a little. At Lee Chong's, they stopped and looked into the messy display window where tools and clothes and food crowded for attention. Swinging their hands and scuffing their feet, they came to the end of Cannery Row and turned up to the railroad track. The girls climbed up on the rails and walked along on them, and the soldiers put their arms around the plump waists to keep them from falling. Then they went past the boatworks and turned down into the park-like property of the Hopkins Marine Station. There is a tiny curved beach in front of the station, a miniature beach between little reefs. The gentle morning waves licked up the beach and whispered softly. The fine smell of seaweed came from the exposed rocks. As the four came to the beach, a sliver of sun broke over Tom Work's land across the head of the bay, and it gilded the water and made the rocks yellow. The girls sat formally down in the sand and straightened their skirts over their knees. One of the soldiers punched holes in four cans of beer and handed them around. And then the men lay down and put their heads in the girls' laps and looked up into their faces. And they smiled at each other. A tired and peaceful and wonderful secret. From up near the station came the barking of a dog. The watchman, a dark and surly man, had seen them, and his black and surly cocker spaniel had seen them. He shouted at them, and when they did not move, he came down on the beach, and his dog barked monotonously. "Don't you know you can't lay around here? You gotta get off. This is private property." The soldiers did not even seem to hear him. They smiled on, and the girls were stroking their hair over the temples. At last, in slow motion, one of the soldiers turned his head so that his cheek was cradled between the girl's legs. He smiled benevolently at the caretaker. "Why don't you take a flying fug at the moon?" he said kindly. And he turned back to look at the girl. The sun lighted her blonde hair, and she scratched him over one ear. They didn't even see the caretaker go back to his house.
Chapter 15. By the time the boys got up to the farmhouse, Mac was in the kitchen. The pointer bitch lay on her side, and Mac held a cloth saturated with Epsom salts against her tick bite. Among her legs, the big, fat wiener pups nuzzled and bumped for milk, and the bitch looked patiently up into Mac's face, saying, "You see how it is? I tried to tell him, but he doesn't understand." The captain held a lamp and looked down on Mac. "I'm glad to know about that," he said. Mac said, "I don't want to tell you about your business, sir, but these pups ought to be weaned. She ain't got a hell of a lot of milk left, and them pups are chewing her to pieces." "I know," said the captain. "I suppose I should have drowned them all but one. I've been so busy trying to keep the place going. People don't take the interest in bird dogs they used to. It's all poodles and boxers and Dobermans." "I know," said Mac. "And there ain't no dog like a pointer for a man. I don't know what's come over people, but you wouldn't have drowned them, would you, sir?" "Well," said the captain, "since my wife went into politics, I'm just running crazy. She got elected to the assembly for this district, and when the legislature isn't in session, she's off making speeches. And when she's home, she's studying all the time and writing bills." Must be lousy in... I mean, it must be pretty lonely, said Mac. Now, if I had a pup like this... He picked up a squirming, puzz-faced pup. Why, I bet I'd have a real bird dog in 3 years. I'd take a bitch every time. Would you like to have one? The captain asked. Mac looked up. You mean you'd let me have one? Oh, Jesus Christ, yes. Take your pick, said the captain. Nobody seems to understand bird dogs anymore. The boys stood in the kitchen and gathered quick impressions. It was obvious that the wife was away. The opened cans, the frying pan with lace from fried eggs still sticking to it, the crumbs on the kitchen table, the open box of shotgun shells on the bread box all shrieked of the lack of a woman, while the white curtains and the papers on the dish shelves and the two small towels on the rack told them a woman had been there. And they were unconsciously glad she wasn't there. The kind of women who put papers on shelves and had little towels like that instinctively distrusted and disliked Mac and the boys. Such women knew that they were the worst threats to a home, for they offered ease and thought and companionship as opposed to neatness, order, and properness. They were very glad she was away. Now, the captain seemed to feel that they were doing him a favor. He didn't want them to leave. He said hesitantly, "Suppose you boys would like a little something to warm you up before you go out for the frogs?" The others looked at Mac. Mac was frowning as though he was thinking it through. "When we're out doing scientific stuff, we make it a kind of rule not to touch nothing," he said, and then quickly, as though he might have gone too far, "but seeing as how you've been so nice to us, well, I wouldn't mind a short one myself. I don't know about the boys." The boys agreed that they wouldn't mind a short one either. The captain got a flashlight and went down in the cellar. They could hear him moving lumber and boxes about, and he came back upstairs with a 5-gallon oak keg in his arms. He set it on the table. "During Prohibition, I got some corn whiskey and laid it away. I just got to thinking I'd like to see how it is. It's pretty old now. I'd almost forgot it. You see, my wife..." He let it go at that because it was apparent that they understood. The captain knocked out the oak plug from the end of the keg and got glasses down from the shelf that had scallop-edged paper laid on it. It's a hard job to pour a small drink from a 5-gallon keg. Each of them got half a water glass of the clear brown liquor. They waited ceremoniously for the captain, and then they said, "Over the river," and tossed it back. They swallowed, tasted their tongues, sucked their lips, and there was a faraway look in their eyes. Mac peered into his empty glass as though some holy message were written in the bottom, and then he raised his eyes. "You can't say nothing about that," he said. "They don't put that in bottles." He breathed in deeply and sucked his breath as it came out. "I don't think I ever tasted nothing as good as that," he said. The captain looked pleased. His glance wandered back to the keg. "It is good," he said. "You think we might have another little one?" Mac stared into his glass again. "Maybe a short one," he agreed. "Wouldn't it be easier to pour out some in a pitcher? You're liable to spill it that way." 2 hours later, they recalled what they had come for. The frog pool was square, 50 feet wide and 70 feet long and 4 feet deep. Lush, soft grass grew about its edge, and a little ditch brought the water from the river to it, and from it little ditches went out to the orchards. There were frogs there all right, thousands of them. Their voices beat the night. They boomed and barked and croaked and rattled. They sang to the stars, to the waning moon, to the waving grasses. They bellowed love songs and challenges. The men crept through the darkness toward the pool. The captain carried a nearly filled pitcher of whiskey, and every man had his own glass. The captain had found them flashlights that worked. Huey and Jones carried gunny sacks. As they drew quietly near, the frogs heard them coming. The night had been roaring with frog song, and then suddenly it was silent. Mac and the boys and the captain sat down on the ground to have one last short one and to map their campaign. And the plan was bold. During the millennia that frogs and men have lived in the same world, it is probable that men have hunted frogs. And during that time, a pattern of hunt and parry has developed. The man with net or bow or lance or gun creeps noiselessly, as he thinks, toward the frog. The pattern requires that the frog sit still, sit very still, and wait. The rules of the game require the frog to wait until the final flicker of a second, when the net is descending, when the lance is in the air, when the finger squeezes the trigger. Then the frog jumps, plops into the water, swims to the bottom, and waits until the man goes away. That is the way it is done, the way it has always been done. Frogs have every right to expect it will always be done that way. Now and then, the net is too quick, the lance pierces, the gun flicks, and that frog is gone. But it is all fair and in the framework. Frogs don't resent that. But how could they have anticipated Mac's new method? How could they have foreseen the horror that followed? The sudden flashing of lights, the shouting and squealing of men, the rush of feet. Every frog leaped, plopped into the pool, and swam frantically to the bottom. Then into the pool plunged the line of men, stamping, churning, moving in a crazy line up the pool, flinging their feet about. Hysterically, the frogs, displaced from their placid spot, swam ahead of the crazy thrashing feet, and the feet came on. Frogs are good swimmers, but they haven't much endurance. Down the pool they went until finally they were bunched and crowded against the end, and the feet and wildly plunging bodies followed them. A few frogs lost their heads and floundered among the feet and got through. And these were saved, but the majority decided to leave this pool forever, to find a new home in a new country where this kind of thing didn't happen. A wave of frantic, frustrated frogs, big ones, little ones, brown ones, green ones, men frogs and women frogs, a wave of them broke over the bank, crawled, leaped, scrambled. They clambered up the grass. They clutched at each other. Little ones rode on big ones. And then, horror on horror, the flashlights found them. Two men gathered them like berries. The line came out of the water and closed in on their rear and gathered them like potatoes. Tens and fifties of them were flung into the gunny sacks, and the sacks filled with tired, frightened and disillusioned frogs, with dripping, whimpering frogs. Some got away, of course, and some had been saved in the pool, but never in frog history had such an execution taken place. Frogs by the pound, by the 50 pounds. They weren't counted, but there must have been 600 or 700. Then happily Mac tied up the necks of the sacks. They were soaking, dripping wet, and the air was cool. They had a short one in the grass before they went back to the house so they wouldn't catch cold. It is doubtful whether the captain had ever had so much fun. He was indebted to Mac and the boys. Later, when the curtains caught fire and were put out with the little towels, the captain told the boys not to mind it. He felt it was an honor to have them burn his house clear down if they wanted to. "My wife is a wonderful woman," he said, in a kind of peroration. "Most wonderful woman. Ought to have been a man. If she was a man, I wouldn't have married her." He laughed a long time over that, and repeated it 3 or 4 times, and resolved to remember it so he could tell it to a lot of other people. He filled a jug with whiskey and gave it to Mac. He wanted to go to live with them in the palace flophouse. He decided that his wife would like Mac and the boys if she only knew them. Finally, he went to sleep on the floor with his head among the puppies. Mac and the boys poured themselves a short one and regarded him seriously. Mac said, "He gave me that jug of whiskey, didn't he? You heard him." "Sure he did," said Eddie. "I heard him." "And he give me a pup." "Sure. Pick of the litter. We all heard him. Why?" "I never did roll a drunk, and I ain't gonna start now," said Mac. "We gotta get out of here. He's gonna wake up feeling lousy, and it's gonna be all our fault. I just don't want to be here." Mac glanced at the burned curtains, at the floor glistening with whiskey and puppy dirt, at the bacon grease that was coagulating on the stove front. He went to the pups, looked them over carefully, felt bone and frame, looked in eyes and regarded jaws, and he picked out a beautifully spotted bitch with a liver-colored nose and a fine dark yellow eye. "Come on, darling," he said. They blew out the lamp because of the danger of fire. It was just turning dawn as they left the house. "I don't think I ever had such a fine trip," said Mac. "But I got to thinking about his wife coming back, and it gave me the shivers." The pup whined in his arms, and he put it under his coat. "He's a real nice fella," said Mac. "After you get him feeling easy, that is." He strode on toward the place where they had parked the Ford. "We shouldn't go forgetting we're doing all this for Doc," he said. "From the way things are panning out, it looks like Doc is a pretty lucky guy." Chapter 16. Probably the busiest time the girls of the Bear Flag ever had was the march of the big sardine catch. It wasn't only that the fish ran in silvery billions and money ran almost as freely. A new regiment moved into the Presidio, and a new bunch of soldiers always shop around a good deal before they settle down. Dora was short-handed just at that time, too, for Eva Flanagan had gone to East St. Louis on a vacation. Phyllis May had broken her leg getting out of the roller coaster in Santa Cruz, and Elsie Doublebottom had made a novena and wasn't much good for anything else. The men from the sardine fleet, loaded with dough, were in and out all afternoon. They sail at dark and fish all night, so they must play in the afternoon. In the evening, the soldiers of the new regiment came down and stood around playing the jukebox and drinking Coca-Cola and sizing up the girls for the time when they would be paid. Dora was having trouble with her income tax, for she was entangled in that curious enigma which said the business was illegal and then taxed her for it. In addition to everything else, there were the regulars, the steady customers who had been coming down for years, the laborers from the gravel pits, the riders from the ranches, the railroad men who came in the front door, and the city officials and prominent businessmen who came in the rear entrance back by the tracks and who had little chintz sitting rooms assigned to them. All in all, it was a terrific month. And right in the middle of it, the influenza epidemic had to break out. It came to the whole town. Mrs. Talbot and her daughter of the San Carlos Hotel had it. Tom Work had it. Benjamin Peabody and his wife had it. Excellentissima Maria Antonia Field had it. The whole Gross family came down with it. The doctors of Monterey, and there were enough of them to take care of the ordinary diseases, accidents, and neuroses, were running crazy. They had more business than they could do among clients who, if they didn't pay their bills, at least had the money to pay them. Cannery Row, which produces a tougher breed than the rest of the town, was late in contracting it, but finally it got them too. The schools were closed. There wasn't a house that hadn't feverish children and sick parents. It was not a deadly disease, as it was in 1917, but with children it had a tendency to go into the mastoids. The medical profession was very busy, and besides, Cannery Row was not considered a very good financial risk. Now, Doc of the Western Biological Laboratory had no right to practice medicine. It was not his fault that everyone in the row came to him for medical advice. Before he knew it, he found himself running from shanty to shanty, taking temperatures, giving physics, borrowing and delivering blankets, and even taking food from house to house where mothers looked at him with inflamed eyes from their beds and thanked him and put the full responsibility for their children's recovery on him. When a case got really out of hand, he phoned a local doctor, and sometimes one came if it seemed to be an emergency. But to the families, it was all emergency. Doc didn't get much sleep. He lived on beer and canned sardines. In Lee Chong's, where he went to get beer, he met Dora, who was there to buy a pair of nail clippers. "You look all done in," Dora said. "I am," Doc admitted. "I haven't had any sleep for about a week now." "I know," said Dora. "I hear it's bad. Comes at a bad time, too." "Well, we haven't lost anybody yet," said Doc. "But there are some awful sick kids. The Ransell kids have all developed mastoiditis." "Is there anything I can do?" Dora asked. Doc said, "You know there is. People get so scared and helpless. Take the Ransells. They're scared to death, and they're scared to be alone. If you or some of the girls could just sit with them." Dora, who was soft as a mouse's belly, could be as hard as carborundum. She went back to the bear flag and organized it for service. It was a bad time for her, but she did it. The Greek cook made a 10-gallon cauldron of strong soup and kept it full and kept it strong. The girls tried to keep up their business, but they went in shifts to sit with the families, and they carried pots of soup when they went. Doc was in almost constant demand. Dora consulted him and detailed the girls where he suggested, and all the time the business at the Bear Flag was booming. The jukebox never stopped playing. The men of the fishing fleet and the soldiers stood in line, and the girls did their work, and then they took their pots of soup and went to sit with the Ransells, with the McCarthys, with the Ferrias. The girls slipped out the back door, and sometimes, staying with the sleeping children, the girls dropped asleep in their chairs. They didn't use makeup for work anymore. They didn't have to. Dora herself said she could have used the total membership of the old ladies' home. It was the busiest time the girls at the Bear Flag could remember. Everyone was glad when it was over. Chapter 17. In spite of his friendliness and his friends, Doc was a lonely and a set-apart man. Mac probably noticed it more than anybody. In a group, Doc seemed always alone. When the lights were on and the curtains drawn and the Gregorian music played on the great phonograph, Mac used to look down on the laboratory from the palace flophouse. He knew Doc had a girl in there, but Mac used to get a dreadful feeling of loneliness out of it. Even in the dear, close contact with the girl, Mac felt that Doc would be lonely. Doc was a night crawler. The lights were on in the lab all night, and yet he seemed to be up in the daytime, too. And the great shrouds of music came out of the lab at any time of the day or night. Sometimes, when it was all dark and when it seemed that sleep had come at last, the diamond-true child voices of the Sistine Choir would come from the windows of the laboratory. Doc had to keep up his collecting. He tried to get to the good tides along the coast. The sea rocks and the beaches were his stockpile. He knew where everything was when he wanted it. All the articles of his trade were filed away on the coast. Sea cradles here, octopi here, tube worms in another place, sea pansies in another. He knew where to get them, but he could not go for them exactly when he wanted, for nature locked up the items and only released them occasionally. Doc had to know not only the tides, but when a particular low tide was good in a particular place. When such a low tide occurred, he packed his collecting tools in his car, he packed his jars, his bottles, his plates and preservatives, and he went to the beach or reef or rock ledge where the animals he needed were stored. Now he had an order for small octopi, and the nearest place to get them was the boulder-strewn intertidal zone at La Jolla, between Los Angeles and San Diego. It meant a 500-mile drive each way, and his arrival had to coincide with the retreating waters. The little octopi live among the boulders embedded in sand. Being timid and young, they prefer a bottom on which there are many caves and little crevices and lumps of mud where they may hide from predators and protect themselves from the waves. But on the same flat, there are millions of sea cradles. While filling a definite order for octopi, Doc could replenish his stock of the cradles. Low tide was 5:17 a.m. on a Thursday. If Doc left Monterey on Wednesday morning, he could be there easily in time for the tide on Thursday. He would have taken someone with him for company, but quite by accident everyone was away or was busy. Mac and the boys were up Carmel Valley collecting frogs. Three young women he knew and would have enjoyed as companions had jobs and couldn't get away in the middle of the week. Henri the painter was occupied, for Holman's department store had employed not a flagpole sitter, but a flagpole skater. On a tall mast on top of the store, he had a little round platform, and there he was on skates going around and around. He had been there for 3 days and 3 nights. He was out to set a new record for being on skates on a platform. The previous record was 127 hours, so he had some time to go. Henri had taken up his post across the street at Red Williams gas station. Henri was fascinated. He thought of doing a huge abstraction called Substratum Dream of a Flagpole Skater. Henri couldn't leave town while the skater was up there. He protested that there were philosophic implications in flagpole skating that no one had touched. Henri sat in a chair, leaned back against the lattice which concealed the door of the men's toilet at Red Williams. He kept his eye on the airy skating platform, and obviously he couldn't go with Doc to La Jolla. Doc had to go alone, because the tide would not wait. Early in the morning, he got his things together. Personal things went in a small satchel. Another satchel held instruments and syringes. Having packed, he combed and trimmed his brown beard, saw that his pencils were in his shirt pocket and his magnifying glass attached to his lapel. He packed the trays, bottles, glass plates, preservatives, rubber boots, and a blanket into the back of his car. He worked through the pearly time, washed 3 days' dishes, put the garbage into the surf. He closed the doors but did not lock them, and by 9 o'clock was on his way. It took Doc longer to go places than other people. He didn't drive fast, and he stopped and ate hamburgers very often. Driving up to Lighthouse Avenue, he waved at a dog that looked around and smiled at him. In Monterey, before he even started, he felt hungry and stopped at Herman's for a hamburger and beer. While he ate his sandwich and sipped his beer, a bit of conversation came back to him. Blaisdell, the poet, had said to him, "You love beer so much, I'll bet someday you'll go in and order a beer milkshake." It was a simple piece of foolery, but it had bothered Doc ever since. He wondered what a beer milkshake would taste like. The idea gagged him, but he couldn't let it alone. It cropped up every time he had a glass of beer. Would it curdle the milk? Would you add sugar? It was like a shrimp ice cream. Once the thing got into your head, you couldn't forget it. He finished his sandwich and paid Herman. He purposely didn't look at the milkshake machines lined up so shiny against the back wall. If a man ordered a beer milkshake, he thought, he'd better do it in a town where he wasn't known. But then, a man with a beard ordering a beer milkshake in a town where he wasn't known, they might call the police. A man with a beard was always a little suspect anyway. You couldn't say you wore a beard because you liked a beard. People didn't like you for telling the truth. You had to say you had a scar so you couldn't shave. Once when Doc was at the University of Chicago, he had love trouble, and he had worked too hard. He thought it would be nice to take a very long walk. He put on a little knapsack, and he walked through Indiana and Kentucky and North Carolina and Georgia clear to Florida. He walked among farmers and mountain people, among the swamp people and fishermen, and everywhere people asked him why he was walking through the country. Because he loved true things, he tried to explain. He said he was nervous, and besides, he wanted to see the country, smell the ground, and look at grass and birds and trees, to savor the country, and there was no other way to do it save on foot. And people didn't like him for telling the truth. They scowled, or shook and tapped their heads. They laughed as though they knew it was a lie, and they appreciated a liar. And some, afraid for their daughters or their pigs, told him to move on, to get going, just not to stop near their place if he knew what was good for him. And so he stopped trying to tell the truth. He said he was doing it on a bet, that he stood to win $100. Everyone liked him then and believed him. They asked him in to dinner and gave him a bed, and they put lunches up for him and wished him good luck and thought he was a hell of a fine fellow. Doc still loved true things, but he knew it was not a general love, and it could be a very dangerous mistress. Doc didn't stop in Salinas for a hamburger, but he stopped in Gonzales, in King City, and in Paso Robles. He had hamburger and beer at Santa Maria, two in Santa Maria because it was a long pull from there to Santa Barbara. In Santa Barbara, he had soup, lettuce and string bean salad, pot roast and mashed potatoes, pineapple pie and blue cheese and coffee. And after that, he filled the gas tank and went to the toilet. While the service station checked his oil and tires, Doc washed his face and combed his beard, and when he came back to the car, a number of potential hitchhikers were waiting. "Going south, mister?" Doc traveled on the highways a good deal. He was an old hand. You have to pick your hitchhikers very carefully. It's best to get an experienced one, for he relapses into silence. But the new ones try to pay for their ride by being interesting. Doc had had a leg talked off by some of these. Then, after you've made up your mind about the one you want to take, you protect yourself by saying you aren't going far. If your man turns out too much for you, you can drop him. On the other hand, you may be just lucky and get a man very much worth knowing. Doc made a quick survey of the line and chose his company, a thin-faced salesman-like man in a blue suit. He had deep lines beside his mouth and dark, brooding eyes. He looked at Doc with dislike.
"Going south, mister?"
"Yes," said Doc, "a little way."
"Mind taking me along?"
"Get in," said Doc. When they got to Ventura, it was pretty soon after the heavy dinner, so Doc only stopped for beer. The hitchhiker hadn't spoken once.
Doc pulled up at a roadside stand. Want some beer? No, said the hitchhiker. And I don't mind saying I think it's not a very good idea to drive under the influence of alcohol. It's none of my business what you do with your own life, but in this case you've got an automobile, and that can be a murderous weapon in the hands of a drunken driver. At the beginning, Doc had been slightly startled. Get out of the car, he said softly. What? I'm going to punch you in the nose, said Doc, if you aren't out of this car before I count ten. One, two, three. The man fumbled at the door catch and backed hurriedly out of the car, but once outside he howled, I'm going to find an officer. I'm going to have you arrested. Doc opened the box on the dashboard and took out a monkey wrench. His guest saw the gesture and walked hurriedly away. Doc walked angrily to the counter of the stand. The waitress, a blonde beauty with just the hint of a goiter, smiled at him.
What'll it be?
Beer milkshake, said Doc.
What?
Well, here it was, and what the hell? Might just as well get it over with now as sometime later. The blonde asked,
Are you kidding?
Doc knew wearily that he couldn't explain, couldn't tell the truth.
I've got a bladder complaint, he said. Bipalacatorsinectomy, the doctors call it. I'm supposed to drink a beer milkshake. Doctor's orders.
The blonde smiled reassuringly.
Oh, I thought you was kidding, she said archly. You tell me how to make it. I didn't know you were sick.
Very sick, said Doc, and due to be sicker. Put in some milk and add half a bottle of beer. Give me the other half in a glass, no sugar in the milkshake. When she served it, he tasted it wryly.
And it wasn't so bad. It just tasted like stale beer and milk.
It sounds awful, said the blonde.
It's not so bad when you get used to it, said Doc. I've been drinking it for 17 years.
Chapter 18. Doc had driven slowly. It was late afternoon when he stopped in Ventura, so late, in fact, that when he stopped in Carpinteria, he only had a cheese sandwich and went to the toilet. Besides, he intended to get a good dinner in Los Angeles, and it was dark when he got there. He drove on through and stopped at a big chicken-in-the-rough place he knew about. And there, he had fried chicken, julienne potatoes, hot biscuits and honey, and a piece of pineapple pie and blue cheese. And here he filled his thermos bottle with hot coffee, had the make-up 6 ham sandwiches, and bought 2 quarts of beer for breakfast. It was not so interesting driving at night. No dogs to see, only the highway lighted with his headlights. Doc speeded up to finish the trip. It was about 2 o'clock when he got to La Jolla. He drove through the town and down to the cliff below which his tidal flat lay. There he stopped the car, ate a sandwich, drank some beer, turned out the lights, and curled up in the seat to sleep. He didn't need a clock. He had been working in a tidal pattern so long that he could feel a tide change in his sleep. In the dawn, he awakened, looked out through the windshield, and saw that the water was already retreating down the bouldery flat. He drank some hot coffee, ate 3 sandwiches, and had a quart of beer. The tide goes out imperceptibly. The boulders show and seem to rise up, and the ocean recedes, leaving little pools, leaving wet weed and moss and sponge, iridescence and brown and blue and china red. On the bottoms lie the incredible refuse of the sea, shells broken and chipped, and bits of skeleton, claws,
the whole sea bottom a fantastic cemetery on which the living scamper and scramble. Doc pulled on his rubber boots and set his rain hat fussily. He took his buckets and jars and his crowbar and put his sandwiches in one pocket and his thermos bottle in another pocket, and he went down the cliff to the tidal flat. Then he worked down the flat after the retreating sea. He turned over the boulders with his crowbar, and now and then his hand darted quickly into the standing water and brought out a little angry, squirming octopus, which blushed with rage and spat ink on his hand. Then he dropped it into a jar of seawater with the others, and usually the newcomer was so angry that it attacked its fellows. It was good hunting that day. He got 22 little octopi. And he picked off several hundred sea cradles and put them in his wooden bucket. As the tide moved out, he followed it while the morning came and the sun rose. The flat extended out 200 yards, and then there was a line of heavy weed-crusted rocks before it dropped off to deep water. Doc worked out to the barrier edge. He had about what he wanted now, and the rest of the time he looked under stones, leaned down and peered into the tide pools with their brilliant mosaics and their scuttling, bubbling life. And he came at last to the outer barrier, where the long, leathery brown algae hung down into the water. Red starfish clustered on the rocks, and the sea pulsed up and down against the barrier, waiting to get in again. Between two weeded rocks on the barrier, Doc saw a flash of white under water, and then the floating weed covered it. He climbed to the place over the slippery rocks, held himself firmly, and gently reached down and parted the brown algae. Then he grew rigid. A girl's face looked up at him, a pretty, pale girl with dark hair. The eyes were open and clear, and the face was firm, and the hair washed gently about her head. The body was out of sight, caught in the crevice. The lips were slightly parted, and the teeth showed, and on the face was only comfort and rest. Just under water it was, and the clear water made it very beautiful. It seemed to Doc that he looked at it for many minutes, and the face burned into his picture memory. Very slowly he raised his hand and let the brown weed float back and cover the face. Doc's heart pounded deeply, and his throat felt tight. He picked up his bucket and his jars and his crowbar and went slowly over the slippery rocks back toward the beach. And the girl's face went ahead of him. He sat down on the beach in the coarse, dry sand and pulled off his boots. In the jar, the little octopi were huddled up, each keeping as far as possible from the others. Music sounded in Doc's ears, a high, thin, piercingly sweet flute carrying a melody he could never remember, and against this, a pounding, surf-like woodwind section. The flute went up into regions beyond the hearing range, and even there it carried its unbelievable melody. Goose pimples came out on Doc's arms. He shivered, and his eyes were wet the way they get in the focus of great beauty. The girl's eyes had been gray and clear, and the dark hair floated, drifted lightly over the face. The picture was set for all time. He sat there while the first little spout of water came over the reef, bringing the returning tide. He sat there hearing the music while the sea crept in again over the bouldery flat. His hand tapped out the rhythm, and the terrifying flute played in his brain. The eyes were gray, and the mouth smiled a little, or seemed to catch its breath in ecstasy. A voice seemed to awaken him. A man stood over him.
Been fishing?
No. Collecting.
Well, what are them things?
Baby octopi.
You mean devilfish? I didn't know there was any here. I've lived here all my life.
You've got to look for them, said Doc listlessly.
Say, said the man, aren't you feeling well? You look sick.
The flute climbed again, and plucked cellos sounded below, and the sea crept in and in toward the beach. Doc shook off the music, shook off the face, shook the chill out of his body.
Is there a police station near?
Up in town. Why, what's wrong?
There's a body out on the reef.
Where?
Right out there. Wedged between two rocks. A girl.
Say, said the man, you get a bounty for finding a body. I forget how much.
Doc stood up and gathered his equipment. Will you report it? I'm not feeling well.
Give you a shock, did it? Is it bad, rotten, or eat up?
Doc turned away.
You take the bounty, he said. I don't want it.
He started toward the car. Only the tiniest piping of the flute sounded in his head.
Chapter 19. Probably nothing in the way of promotion Holman's department store ever did attracted so much favorable comment as the engagement of the flagpole skater. Day after day, there he was up on his little round platform, skating around and around, and at night he could be seen up there too, dark against the sky, so that everybody knew he didn't come down. It was generally agreed, however, that a steel rod came up through the center of the platform at night, and he strapped himself to it. But he didn't sit down, and no one minded the steel rod. People came from Jamesburg to see him, and from down the coast as far as Grimes Point. Salinas people came over in droves, and the farmers mercantile of that town put in a bid for the next appearance, when the skater could attempt to break his own record and thus give the new world's record to Salinas. Since there weren't many flagpole skaters, and since this one was by far the best, he had for the last year gone about breaking his own world's record. Holman's was delighted about the venture. They had a white sail, a remnant sail, an aluminum sail, and a crockery sail all going at the same time. Crowds of people stood in the street watching the lone man on his platform. His second day up, he sent down word that someone was shooting at him with an air gun. The display department used its head. It figured the angles and located the offender. It was old Dr. Merivale, hiding behind the curtains of his office, plugging away with a Daisy air rifle. They didn't denounce him, and he promised to stop. He was very prominent in the Masonic Lodge. Henri the painter kept his chair at Red William's service station. He worked out every possible philosophic approach to the situation, and came to the conclusion that he would have to build a platform at home and try it himself. Everyone in the town was more or less affected by the skater. Trade fell out of sight of him, and got better the nearer you came to Holman's. Mac and the boys went up and looked for a moment, and then went back to the palace. They couldn't see that it made much sense. Holman set up a double bed in their window. When the skater broke the world's record, he was going to come down and sleep right in the window without taking off his skates. The trade name of the mattress was on a little card at the foot of the bed. Now, in the whole town, there was interest and discussion about this sporting event, but the most interesting question of all
and the one that bothered the whole town was never spoken of. No one mentioned it, and yet it was there haunting everyone. Mrs. Trollat wondered about it as she came out of the Scotch bakery with a bag of sweet buns. Mr. Hall, in men's furnishings, wondered about it. The three Willoughby girls giggled whenever they thought of it, but no one had the courage to bring it into the open. Richard Frost, a high-strung and brilliant young man, worried about it more than anyone else. It haunted him. Wednesday night he worried, and Thursday night he fidgeted. Friday night he got drunk and had a fight with his wife. She cried for a while and then pretended to be asleep. She heard him slip from bed and go into the kitchen. He was getting another drink, and then she heard him dress quietly and go out. She cried some more then. It was very late. Mrs. Frost was sure he was going down to Dora's bear flag. Richard walked sturdily down the hill through the pines until he came to Lighthouse Avenue. He turned left and went up toward Holman's. He had the bottle in his pocket, and just before he came to the store he took one more slug of it. The street lights were turned down low. The town was deserted. Not a soul moved. Richard stood in the middle of the street and looked up. Dimly.